Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This week, we're asking various guests and listeners to tell us about the first album they ever bought with their own money. Not the records your older sibling or cousin gave you, but the first time you spent your money on a record. Comedian Tig Notaro joined us in the Green Space not too long ago to share one of her improbable and hilarious stories, so I took the opportunity to pose the question to her. What was the first record you ever bought with your own money? Do you remember?
I do. The Pretenders 2. A Pretenders cassette.
Oh, it was a cassette?
It was a cassette.
Nice.
I had a bunch of Beatles and Rolling Stones records, but I didn't buy those. We had a friend from England that would come over and visit and stay with us, and he would bring us Beatles and Rolling Stones records. Like we couldn't get those in the States. But we were just like, oh my gosh.
Take care of each other when love walks in the room. Everybody stand up. Oh, it's good, good, good. Like Brigitte Bardot.
So this 1981 record by the Pretenders was Tig Notaro's first music purchase. What was yours? Leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612 or tell us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll hear more from Tig Notaro in just a bit. Our live music today comes from Michael Cronin, whose album of power pop takes on a kind of punk edge when he plays it live. And speaking of punk... In Detroit, in the 1970s, three brothers formed a band called Death. Now, the name might indicate this was not your typical Motown sound. A new documentary chronicles the story of a proto-punk group that never really caught a break until now. Death bassist and vocalist Bobby Hackney is here with me in the studio today. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how you doing?
And filmmaker Jeff Howlett, one of the men behind a band called Death, is with us on the phone. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Look, I am not a particularly big guy. I hope I'm not a stupid guy, but I watched much of your film, Jeff, with a big, stupid grin plastered on my face. What a great story, and what a crazy story this is, of a band that never really gets off the ground, tapes in an attic for decades, and tapes, Bobby, that were made by you, your brother David, and your brother Dennis, which looks like Dennis, although everyone pronounces it Dennis, it seems.
Yeah, it's D-A-N-N-I-S. That's Dennis, right.
Right. So you're three black guys in Detroit who are not playing Motown. You're playing something that's much closer to what would become punk rock.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we, well, you know, we started out, I mean, we come from all that great legacy of Motown. I mean, you know, our mom and dad, you know, they, our first real, you know, run with 45s was the Chess record label. You know, we remember like the old Etta James and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and, of course, Chuck Berry. Mm-hmm. All that stuff came into our house. But
now your dad was a minister, right?
Yeah, he was a Baptist minister, but he was in tune to a lot of history. So he had us to sit down to watch events like the March on Washington. And, of course, when the Beatles came in that February of 1964, it was just such an electric time in America. And everybody was tuned into it. And my dad, you know, we're on Sunday night, you know, watching Ed Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dad says, I want you boys to sit down here because you're about to watch history being made.
Your dad said that.
My dad said that.
Your dad must have been the only dad in America who said that. Because most dads were like, what is this? Get this, people. Look at them. They look like shaggy dogs.
Well, you know, he knew. I mean, that was the banter of everybody's life. I mean, on Sunday night, that was families got together and watched Ed Sullivan. So he really saw this as being a historic event, and he wanted us to sit down and watch it. Maybe he was just trying to get us to be good, you know? I don't know. But at any rate, he did tell us, and we sit down, and when we watched that, that planted the seeds for us wanting to be a band. And then, you know, of course, we went through the 60s, and, you know, growing up, we didn't really become full-fledged serious about being a band until about 1971. Mm-hmm. And we started a band, and we called ourselves Rock Fire Funk Express, you know, because, you know, at the time, you know,
it was a safe name. You know which way you're going to go. Yeah,
exactly. Rock, funk, you know, everything that was kind of happening at the times. You know.
We're speaking with Bobby Hackney, bassist and vocalist of the Detroit band Death, and Jeff Howlett, one of the filmmakers behind the documentary, splendid documentary called A Band Called Death. So the three of you, you, Bobby, Dennis, and David, form this band. You're playing both sides with the rock and the funk, and then it's David who comes up with the name for the band, which I want to get to in a moment. But, but you know, did you guys know what you were doing, or were you just kind of like figuring it out as you went along?
I think that's what we were doing. You know, what we loved was, we had seen all these great bands, you know, like Ted Nugent, the Amboy Dukes, Grand Funk Railroad, and we really loved that sound. We just immersed ourselves in rock and roll. I mean, it was my brother Dennis who really saw the first Alice Cooper concert that he saw. Really, it was by mistake, because they were actually on their way to a Motown party, which was happening in another part of the facility, but they had to go through Cobo Arena, which Alice Cooper's concert was in progress at the time.
Wow.
So they're in the very back trying to get out the back
trying
door.
To get out.
But Dennis just becomes mesmerized with this, you know, I mean, he saw them on stage at Alice Cooper, the Billion Dollar Babies tour, with this boa constrictor and everything. And Dennis just loved it. He loved the way the drummer played. And he came back home and he said, "Guys, we got to play this music."
And well, that, you know, folks at this point have got to be wondering, what could this band have sounded like? Well, this is what Death sounded like back in the early 70s in Detroit.
1, 2, 3, now!
Just a little bit from the band Death, proto-punk from three brothers in Detroit in the early 1970s. Politicians in My Eyes is the song. The documentary is A Band Called Death. It's playing in limited theaters nationwide. It's available on iTunes and video on demand. We're speaking with Bobby Hackney, Sr., the bassist and vocalist in the band, Jeff Howlett, one of the filmmakers behind the documentary. And Jeff, much of the documentary centers on how the name of the band affects their career. At what point in the making of this film did you realize that you had more than just, you know, kind of an unusual rockumentary on your hands?
Pretty much right out of the gate. I mean, I had a conversation with Bobby Hackney Jr. just sort of give me the whole gist of the story, and he just told me all these things about his family that were just so rich and beautiful. When we sat down and started interviewing Bobby Sr. and Dennis about it, I mean, it just blew wide open. I mean, we knew we had something special just from the very beginning, and you know, just knowing the family for years and exploring, sort of opening it up to the extended family and interviewing Earl, you know, and some of the other members of the family.
Earl is your older brother.
Oldest brother, yeah.
And the only one of the four who was not in the band.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and it just sort of opened the doors up. And then, you know, the more we talked to everyone, the more, everyone was just mentioning David and, and how special David meant to everyone in the family. And then, you know, getting, acknowledgement from the community of musicians as well. Like, wow, these guys really have their chops, not just in Vermont, but we're talking nationally, internationally, about the music. And, you know, when you put the needle down on, you know, the album for the whole world to see, I mean, I as a musician just think it's, you know, in the top 10 of all time records myself.
Ask you about the, you know, the band's name, Death. David came up with the name.
Yes, he did.
And in the documentary, you and Dennis are reluctant at first, and then even more reluctant as things start happening. What was the rationale behind the name to begin with?
Well, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, David, when we had immersed ourselves in rock and roll, we didn't have a name. I mean, Rockfire Funk Express just didn't fit all this great, new, and exciting music we were playing. We wanted a rock and roll name. And so we milled around with a few names, but none of them seemed to roll off the tongue right. And, you know, I worked downtown and went to school and worked part-time downtown. Dennis worked downtown. And so when we come home, that would be our meeting time. And David says, summons up to the room. He says, come on, guys. He says, I got the name. I finally got the name. And we just ran up the stairs, you know, with bated breath. We were just waiting, you know, for this great name. And he looks at us with all the dramatic flair of any actor could ever muster up. And he says, I got the name. He says, what is it? He says, Death. And he looked at us like we were just supposed to love it right off.
Uh-huh.
And we were like, oh, man. I mean, we kind of saw the burden of that right away, you know. We're like, man, people are going to be scared of us, you know. Or we're not like this dark and gory band. We don't want to be. But what he explained to us, when he explained to us the concept that, you know, as my brother Dennis says, that what David meant was that it wasn't, death was not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's just a progression of life. It's just a progression of what we go through. So with that concept, and we saw that it was a much deeper meaning. I mean, he pulled us in, and we became impassioned about it just as much as he did.
Well, there are moments in the documentary, though, when labels start backing away and saying, yeah, at one point you're ready to sign a contract, but they want you to change the name.
Right.
And it's David who sticks to his guns and says, no way.
That's right.
You exactly and Dennis are you're quoted in the film as saying, I would have changed it like
that. Well, yeah. That, you know, my brother Dennis says that, you know. I was the youngest guy, you know. And the thing about it is, you know, back during those days, I mean, our dad had instilled in us to always back up each other. Mm-hmm. And also the fact of the matter is, in the 60s, you know, it was always that hierarchy. You know, like the oldest brother was second in command, and of course, and David was the oldest of the group, though he wasn't the oldest brother.
Earl was the oldest.
But David had to. He was the guitar player. I mean, in the 60s, the guitar player rules.
But
thanks to Jimi Hendrix,
you were the main songwriter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, David would. He always depended on me to write the lyrics because, you know, I had been a poetry writer from third grade. For the most part, David was just, he always told me, he said, I want you to express, you know, what I'm saying at the very beginning.
So he was not just the older brother, he was sort of the heart of the
band. Oh, yeah,
he
was. He was the mentor. He was the one who was, He was kind of our director.
Yeah.
He was our director.
The band is Death. The film is A Band Called Death. Bobby Hackney is the bassist and vocalist from that trio, and Jeff Howlett, along with Mark Covino, put together this really terrific documentary, A Band Called Death, playing in select theaters and available nationwide on video on demand and iTunes. Jeff, having gone through the whole process of making this film and telling this story, how much of the travails, the, you know, the almost signed contracts, the almost record deals, how much of that do you put down to the name of the band?
I mean, it's, you know, it just weighs heavy, especially, you know, just the whole, you know, thing behind, you know, it's documented in the Clive Davis one, you know, they're not going to change their name for anyone and just sticking their guns. I mean, it was just amazing, you know, to see that after all that time, you know, I myself as a musician and a lover of punk rock, you know, from the time I was 12, I've been playing in different punk rock bands, and just to hear this stuff, I felt the same way as Julian, you know. Bob, why don't you tell me about this?
Julian, I mean, being another of Bobby's sons.
Yeah.
And, you
so
know.
So you never told your own kids about Death?
Well, you know what? They had always, I mean, we went through a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
We went through a lot of rejection with Death. Now,
do you think it was all name related? Was some of it because you're three black guys playing rock music?
Well, it was all name related. I
it
mean,
was.
You know,
okay.
But you know, it's funny because people asked us, they said, well, did you go through any racial? I mean, it was really more or less in our own black community. I mean, that we went through that because it was like, look, we don't want to hear that. You guys should be playing Al Green, or you should be playing James Brown, or, you know, the Funkadelics, or mm-hmm. something. Make mm-hmm. us. And, you know, my brother even said that the girls, you know, in our community used to say, y'all better play something that can make us dance. You know, and they would say it just like that. So, you know, we went through a lot of that, you know. Like, they didn't want us to play rock and roll. They thought we should be playing something. And then we even had a couple of our friends who said, look, it's bad enough that you guys are three black guys playing rock, but your name is Death, you know. And so, you know, we went through a lot of rejection. And, you know, as a parent, you want your kids to see your successes.
Right.
You want them to gravitate to the things that you did right. And you know, I wanted to keep them in bliss because they knew us as reggae artists. We had marginal success with our band Lamb's Bread. They grew up seeing this. So we're like, look, why kind of go through that pain? I wanted to keep them in bliss. And we, you know, by the mid or the early 80s, we did like everybody else. We gravitated to Walkmans and CD players. So we didn't, even though those tapes were sitting up there that we brought from Detroit, we never had a reel-to-reel tape that was available to us. Not that we couldn't get one, where we could sit around on a Sunday and go, hey,
and
kids, let's listen to some Death, you know?
Although, I think I would pay good money to hear a dad sit down and say to his kids, hey, let's listen to some Death.
Yeah.
Jeff, for me, the most striking moment in the film is when David, who dies in the year 2000, before he dies, brings those master tapes from Detroit to, is it Bobby,
yes,
your house in Vermont?
Yes.
Hands them over and says, what?
He says, you know, Bob, I know you'll keep these. And, you know, Bob is a collector, right? Collector of many things. And, you know, he keeps them safe in his attic for all this many years.
Because,
you know?
Because he says, someday.
Someday the whole world will come looking for these.
Yeah,
and I know you'll have it.
So he knew, despite all the rejection, he had some inkling that somehow the world would beat a path to Bobby Hackney's attic in Vermont.
Well, he didn't really know it was going to be the attic, but he knew that I would keep him somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, what's really kind of poignant and painful for me and Dennis is that this all happened within 2 months before David died. And he had even told Dennis, you know, he says, Dennis, you're not going to see me anymore. He says, when you guys make it with this music, I'm not going to be here. And David was always philosophical, and we thought that was another one of his philosophical moments. We was like, come on, man, don't say this. I mean, my brother was even at his wedding, you know. He said, come on, David, it's my wedding, you know. But David, he did know, and he knew that how sick he was. even though he was keeping it from the rest of the family.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
So what happens, Jeff? The bloggers, you know, get hold of one of those. The guys had printed up 500 copies of one of their singles on their own. They didn't get the record label. They didn't sign the deal. They released it on their own, and it sort of goes into obscurity. And somebody finds it. It's played at an underground DJ, you know, event. And these things start selling for like $800 on eBay, if you can find them. So
that's
it was kind of an internet phenomenon, this rediscovery, right?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, just, you know, the post on Chunklet sort of went around, you know, it got around. And then, you know, that's when Robert Cole Manis, who is a very avid record collector and was working with Drag City Records out of Chicago, says, hey, you know, they came to him, you know, he said, hey, this is a great 7-inch, you guys should check this out, because he was one that actually, he bought the 7-inch and brought it to them and said, listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, this is great, you know, maybe we should maybe talk about maybe...
Was that Politicians in My Eyes, the single?
Politicians in My Eyes,
right,
and Keep On Knocking.
Yeah. Right.
And he said, you know, this is great, you guys should... You know, you should talk about putting this out. And they said, well, this is great, but maybe we should put out, you know, see if they have any more. And that's when a call came to Bobby from Robert, yep, saying, hey, do you have anything? And then, you know, the whole attic.
Yeah.
Where was the funny call that day?
They say there's no second acts in American Lives, but for Death, at least for you, Bobby, and your brother Dennis, there has been a second act, and now there's... After, what, 35, almost 40 years, a new single.
35, yes, yes.
Well, coming out later this month, called Relief.
Yes. You know, we basically, people have asked, you know, since the record came out, what's next? You know, well, we completed a whole album, and we're just happy about that. And six of those songs are from the Death Songwriting Archive from the 70s that me and David did. A lot of those songs we thought would never get to see the light of the studio. And Bobby Duncan, who is kind of that, we feel he's handpicked by David, but mm-hmm. he's filling in for David. And he was so inspired by this story and what he's been going through. He came to us with a song idea, and me and Dennis worked together with it on him. And the name of it is Relief. And it kind of personifies what we're going through, in that after all these years of playing rock and roll, what a relief it is to play this music again and to feel that way again. And so, you know, we, Draft House, in conjunction with the movie, we gave them permission to put out a limited edition of a replica of the 45 that we put out in Detroit.
So it's a real 45.
It's
you need
a
turntable to play.
Yes, you need a turntable mm-hmm. to play. And we were so inspired by that. that we decided to take two new songs off of this new album and to put those out as a 45 single on vinyl, which will be released later this month. And, you know, it's going to be...
still doing it the hard way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, still doing it the hard way. And it's going to look just like the single that we released in Detroit. And we're really excited about it. And we did this as an honor to David because we know David would love this. I mean, he would. That's the kind of thing that he would do.
The story of this band is an amazing tale, and it is told in this new documentary called A Band Called Death. It is playing at select theaters nationwide. It's also available everywhere on video on demand and iTunes. Jeff Howlett, one of the filmmakers on the line with me, Bobby Hackney, the bassist and vocalist of Death Then and Death Now, here with me in the studio. And guys, I enjoyed the hell out of this movie, out of hearing your story. And I just, you know, you end up at the end of the film just rooting for you, Bobby, and for Dennis. And it's just great
thank
to
you.
Have you here with us on Soundcheck today. Thanks
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you, John.
Jeff,
thank
you, too.
Thank you very much.
Feel.
Coming up, an excerpt from a sold-out soundcheck event in the Green Space last month. Comedian Tig Notaro tells a harrowing yet hilarious tale that reminds us why you should always have someone pick you up at the hospital after surgery. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Like many of you public radio listeners, I first encountered the comedian Tig Notaro when she appeared on the show This American Life, talking about her truly random and absurdly frequent run-ins with the 80s and 90s singer Taylor Dayne. Now, you might also have encountered her acclaimed stand-up record called Live. Looks like Live, but it's pronounced Live because Tig Notaro made it amid a truly difficult year, which included a cancer diagnosis, time in the hospital, and the sudden death of her mom. Comedian Louis C.K. first released Live on his website, and now Tig is releasing an expanded edition on July 16th. She really has a knack for finding humor in scary events, like the one she described when she joined us last month downstairs in the green space. Here's Tig Notaro in front of a live soundcheck audience.
So I got my my wisdom teeth out. I had all four surgically removed. And at the time, I was dating a woman that had her own business. And getting my wisdom teeth out, I had to have somebody drive me and also sign in agreeing that they were going to drive me home. And so my ex did not want to take any time off of work to drive me, or drive me back. She would drive me there. That was the plan. She said, I'll drive you there. I will sign you in, but then I'm going to leave. And I was like, okay, that sounds great. I was 24. And somebody was basically just saying, I'm going to leave you for dead. And I was like, totally fine with me. So she signs me in, she takes off, and then I get put under, and they take out my wisdom teeth. And when they rolled my gurney in to my room where I was supposed to rest, they moved me from the gurney to the hospital bed. And in that move, I woke up and remembered that I did not have a ride home. I was like, okay, I gotta escape. So I concocted this plan that just basically meant I was gonna hop up off the bed and run out of the hospital. And I was so drugged. Like, I had just been under, like, basically dead. So I was running through the halls of the hospital all crooked. And got out to my car. I was like, I only lived like a couple of miles from the hospital, but it was still, it was a major situation. And so I get into my car, I start it up, I drive off, and I get to the first traffic light, and I was awoken when I rear-ended the car in front of me. I mean, how long could the light have been? 30 seconds, I don't know, but I was so relaxed and my foot just, I guess, just slid off the brake. And then I gently tapped the car in front of me. And then he got out and came up to my window and he was like, what's going on? I was just like, yeah, sorry about that. And he was like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, totally fine." I drive off. I get home. And I lived in this three-story Victorian house. And I lived on the attic, in the attic. And my two closest friends that I grew up with and had moved all around the country with lived in the apartment below me. And when I pulled up, I saw my friend Leslie's car parked there. It's like, oh, good, Leslie's home. And the medication, it was starting to wear off. And I needed to get back to the hospital. So I had four gaping holes in my mouth. So I went up on Beth and Leslie's deck, and they had this glass door. Again, I saw Leslie's car parked there, the glass door, and then they had this curtain covering the glass with like this little bit at the bottom where you could see into their house. And I was banging on the door. I was like, "Leslie! Leslie!" No response. And I'm so drugged that I start to make up in my mind that she's in there and she does not want to help me. So then I'm lying on the patio, peeking through that window, just lying on the patio, just banging, "Leslie! Just like, come on." Like, she didn't know what was going on because I was too embarrassed to tell my friends that my ex didn't want to take the day off to, you know, because they'd be like, why didn't she? And I'm like, eh. So I'm banging. I've created in my head, she didn't want to help me out. So I go around. I go down the steps of the patio down to the first floor. I go around to the front of the house. I think if she is home and she just didn't hear me, I'm going to start yelling up to the front of the house. So when I came around, there's this woman lying on a, why is my vocabulary so limited? Not a hammock, any other guesses? Not a sofa. No. Should I just end the story here? I should have learned these words first. Okay, like you lie in them to get sun. Lounge chair, that's all I was looking for. Don't look at me like that. She was like, "Lounge chair." Call it whatever you want. We could even say it was a hammock. It doesn't matter. We could say she was sitting on a tree trunk. She was lying there, sunbathing. So I came around, and when she saw me come around, she was like, and I was like, "I'm so sorry. I just, do you know Leslie and Beth?" And she was like, she was just, "No." "Okay, my friends Leslie and Beth live on the second floor, and they're not answering their door, and I need a ride to the hospital." Have you seen them?" And she was like, "No." She felt very, I think, vulnerable lying there in her bikini, and she was clearly a new neighbor because the people in the basement had moved out, and that's what I added up. This is our new neighbor. So I was like, okay. So I go back around, just one more attempt. Go back up to the, it's made of wood. It is a porch. What was the other guess, though? Deck. I like that, too. You really need to drop your attitude. Yeah, you. You with a bad attitude needs to be dropped. So I go over to the wooden... You know what? I'm not going to be treated like this. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. It's clear that I am going to be treated this way. I went up to the... Now I'm being treated really bad. You know it wasn't that. It was the deck slash porch slash... You know what it was. I went back up there. When I went up to the deck... It was a horrifying sight. There was blood trailing all the way to Beth and Leslie's door. I'm not stupid. I'm horrified now. And I'm like, with more energy, Leslie! Leslie! Somebody has killed Leslie. And I think she has plotted against me, and now I'm feeling bad because I didn't even notice this trail of blood that is my friend. So I'm banging on the door. The door opens. This time the door opens. Leslie opens the door, and she's like, oh my God! And I was like, Ludley! You guys, I didn't know it. You're not going to believe whose blood that was on that wooden area. That was my blood. I had trailed that blood on their porch. And so Leslie, she didn't know I had my wisdom teeth out. So she opens her door. Sees, not only am I bleeding, but my lip is numb. I'm like, my whole mouth is numb. And I'm supposed to be asleep still. I'm supposed to be lying in a hospital bed. But I've driven in a moving, one of those I was in a car driving through town with four bloody gaping holes in my mouth, get there. I thought Leslie was dead. I don't know what she thought was going on. I actually never asked her. But I still feel horribly for the woman that was sunbathing. I mean, at least the guy that I had rear-ended, I appreciated that he was like, are you okay? Where is the woman sunbathing? No question. Just a person with blood pouring out of their mouth and down their shirt comes around the corner. And I was like, hi, I need to... I'm trying to get to the hospital. Like, yeah, I haven't seen Leslie. You guys, that is my story for you. Thank you so much. Good night.
That's comedian Tig Notaro in front of a live soundcheck audience back in June. The expanded version of her CD, Live, comes out on July 16th with bonus material from the storytelling public radio series, The Moth. And speaking of bonus material, you can hear more from Tig Notaro's visit to the Green Space on our website, soundcheck.org. Coming up, a live performance in the studio from singer-songwriter Michael Cronin and his band. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing the voice of Michael Cronin in a song called Am I Wrong? Actually, In the background, you're hearing everything played by Michael Cronin. The San Francisco rocker plays just about every instrument on his latest record called MC2. But that didn't stop him from bringing a full band here into the Soundcheck studio today. They're going to start us off with Michael's song called Wait. This is Michael Cronin, live on Soundcheck. That is Michael Cronin live on Soundcheck with a song called Wait. You'll find it on his new album, MC2, which is out now. Michael Cronin singing, playing guitar, and Chad Yubovich also playing guitar, Michael Anderson on bass, and Emily Epstein behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. And Michael Cronin making his way from the singing mic to his speaking mic, and good to have you in the band here with us on the program today.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. The album has a real kind of power pop sound to it. The live band more the power than the pop, it seems. You know, is that just a function of, you know, being on the road with a small ensemble?
You know, I don't know. It's like, it's, I feel like the records and the live band are two different, entirely different entities, more so than other bands I've been in. So, I don't know, it's like, can't necessarily translate everything on the record because it's so controlled and heavily arranged, so
right.
I don't know. I feel like it's a more exciting show just to blast off.
that song, Wait, on the record, you know, there's all kinds of harmony vocals. The piano leads the way until the first entrance of the electric guitar. When that first entrance happens, it's like, whoa, you know, pin the ears back. You play, I mean, there are a couple of moments on the record where guest musicians play something or other, but it's mostly you doing everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had some talented friends come in and help here and there, but mm-hmm. Majority of it is just me multi-tracking.
So how many different instruments do you play?
Oh, I don't know. I found myself, I guess I'm a jack of all trades and master of none. So I don't know. That's just how I... It's just more fun to me to try to pick up every instrument mm-hmm. rather than just focus on one. You know?
I mean, if someone says, if you meet somebody on the street and say, I'm a musician, they say, what do you play? What's your answer?
I'm a songwriter. I don't know.
All right. Now, you went to Cal Arts, right?
Yeah.
So you have a BFA, a Bachelor of Fine Arts in music. Were you part of the Gamelan, the Balinese Gamelan program there?
Yeah, I did that like all 3 years I was there. It's really fun. I loved it. Yeah.
Now, for folks who haven't had that experience, I mean, that's like serious band playing.
Yeah.
Where it, you know, the music, everybody has like these metallic percussion instruments, and mm-hmm. You got to be listening to each other and sort of like stepping into the brief, minute spaces between the other guy's notes to get in your own, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it was so fun and really challenging. There's just, you know, so many locked in like rhythms going on. You know, you'll play on like the offbeat of bop 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 bop. Every I don't know. It was a trip. It was really, really fun.
And you did that for 3 years.
Yeah.
See, I would think that has to leave some kind of residue somewhere in the songwriting, whether you're aware of it or not.
Yeah, maybe. I think definitely I couldn't place where something like that would influence these pop songs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, everything at that school and studying theory and performance and composition and, like, gamelan.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of that just kind of just generally informed me and generally like helped me think about music in a more like critical, bigger way, I guess. I don't know.
So you mentioned composition. So did you study arranging, orchestration, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just in a program where you basically pick and choose like your own path.
Mm-hmm.
So I just... The same, you know, same of how I approach instruments. I'd rather just study a little bit of everything than focus. So, yeah, I had a good time, learned a lot.
Well, the new album is called MC2, MCII. Does the number 1102 have any special significance to you?
Oh, no. No, I mean,
because MCII, Roman numerals, that's the number 1102.
You know how it worked out? It was like I just liked how it looked.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have no title of an album jumped out at me. And that's what I've been calling it, like on my demos, mm-hmm. just to list it. And I just like how it looks. And I don't know, I like the classic like numeral albums, you know, like Scott Walker's like
right.
records and Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin, yeah.
Plenty of people. I don't know. I like that. So I don't know what the next one. I don't know if it'll be MC3, but
well, at maybe. Some point if you get up to MC5, sorry, that's taken.
Maybe I'll just title the next one MC5 and get it out of the way.
Get it out of the way. Yeah. Michael Cronin's here with us in the studio. First album was called simply Michael Cronin. New album out now is called MC2. Michael and the band are playing Thursday, July 18th at the Museum of Modern Art for their MoMA Nights productions here in New York. And Michael's going to do another song for us with the band. Once again, he's playing guitar, so is Chad Yubovich, Michael Anderson on bass, and Emily Epstein behind the drum kit. And this next song is called Shout It Out. Once again, you'll find a version on the album MC2, but this... is a live performance in the Soundcheck studio.
One, two, three, four.
Michael Cronin and the band live on Soundcheck with a song called Shout It Out. The new album is called MC2. It is out now, and here's another song from it. This one's called Change.
The moon.
once again Michael Cronin and his band live on Soundcheck with a song called Change, which you will find on his new record called MC2. Michael Cronin and the band playing on Thursday, July 18th, back here in New York at MoMA, part of the MoMA Nights summer concert series. Michael, the album is a lot of fun and very different from what we've gotten here in the studio. So it's great hearing both sides of these songs. Thanks very much for performing for us today.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an absolute pleasure.
Michael Cronin with us on Soundcheck. Tomorrow on the show, author Mark Kurlansky has charted the history of cod and of salt, but his latest book explores the impact of a song, Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas. Plus, contemporary Christian artist Amy Grant talks about faith, going to Bonnaroo, and her gay fan base. Plus, she performs songs from her new album, How Mercy Looks From Here. And how the clothing store Urban Outfitters is fueling a revival of vinyl records. That's it for today. See you back here tomorrow for another Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer.